Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Wealth. I'm Alex Steger. I'm joined as ever by Ian Wenick. And today we are also joined by Alec Rich. Alec, great to have you here. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Good to be back.
Good. Well, it's a pleasure to have you, Ian, as well. I don't mean to dismiss your feelings. Are you well?
I'm good. I'm more worried about you because you don't have a mic stand. So you have to just clutch that microphone in front of your face like you're holding on to an infant.
This is not, Ian, you can tell us, is not apparent. This is not how you would hold an infant for many reasons.
That's accurate to me.
But yeah, look, you too are.
Well, I know you have to support the neck, I guess.
Yeah. I just don't think we should open so often with visual references to the recording setup is my general take on this. But anyway, look, we've started now. But yes, listener, I'm holding the mic because we haven't got a stand. Anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about this week. We're here to talk about what some of the biggest stories that have happened in the world of RIAs as ever. And this week, Ian, you're going to kick us off with a big story involving one of the biggest RIAs out there, Creative Planning. So, rather than me tee it up, just let's get straight into it. What's gone on?
So basically what's happening is Creative Planning, which for new listeners, manages $354 billion in assets, one of the biggest independent wealth managers in the entire country. So they're backed by two private equity firms, General Atlantic and TPG. General Atlantic invested in 2020 and TPG invested in 2024. And what is happening is General Atlantic is looking to raise north of $1 billion by going through what is called a secondaries sale process. So what is a secondary sale process, you might be asking, or Alex might be asking in a couple seconds. A secondary sale process is when
Not if you ask it for me first. No, I won't be, but yes, okay, yeah.
In a secondary sale process, a private equity firm looks to buy out or roll over some of the limited partners in the fund in which it holds a portfolio company investment. So basically, put simply, General Atlantic is not trying to exit its stake in Creative Planning. It actually wants to hold on to a significant portion of it, but is trying to give some of its limited partners in the fund that first invested in Creative Planning back in 2020 some liquidity. So those new investors, we heard Blue Owl Capital is one that's interested. Those new investors will buy in, the old LPs will be taken out, and General Atlantic, a secondary benefit, is that they'll be able to hold on to their investment in Creative Planning a little bit longer than the traditional PE 4 to 7 year time horizon. So this resets the clock a little bit.
Okay. And it's doing this in a sort of continuation vehicle is sort of the jargon for how it
Yes, continuation vehicle.
Executes on this trade. Yeah. And so I suppose someone looking at this, so on the surface you go, oh, look, a PE... one of the PE backers is selling out, but the context here is that it's not really, it's not doing it because it wants to, it's doing it to give liquidity to the investors in that fund that invested in Creative Planning originally. Yeah. But General Atlantic, as far as we understand itself, wants to hold on and have this investment for a longer time period than it did. I guess we should emphasize as well, this isn't something that Creative Planning has a ton of control over.
No, this is wholly over to General Atlantic. This is a General Atlantic process. This is not Creative Planning running anything to get new investors. This is a General Atlantic decision.
But at the end of this process, it will have a slightly more diverse investor base than it had before.
Yeah, that's fair to say.
Or a different investor base, yeah. We should say, maybe.
And it's also worth noting that a lot of the investors that would be buying into the General Atlantic stake now through this continuation vehicle, those are pretty similar to the LPs that probably helped fund TPG's purchase of its stake in Creative Planning in the first place.
Okay, but in terms of the overall ownership of Creative Planning, it's still majority, or the controlling ownership is still held by CEO Peter Malouk?
Yes, that's correct. Peter Malouk is still the controlling and majority owner of Creative Planning.
And TPG, we think, then has the next biggest stake in it, or we don't know the
Not 100%
breakdown between
certain.
GA and TPG?
I do know that when General Atlantic first bought into Creative Planning, they had a stake in the teens in Creative Planning. I believe it was probably around like 18% was what I heard most recently. We've seen numbers anywhere from like 13 to 18, but 18 was what I most recently heard.
Okay. And they did sell some of that the same year that TPG
yes.
bought in, probably yes. as part of that deal. Again, we don't know exactly because we don't know the yes. full ins and outs of that.
And I think it's also important to note that the TPG deal with Creative is the main background catalyst for a lot of this, because the TPG deal That gave creative planning an enterprise valuation of about $16 billion, which is absolutely massive. And so to put that into context for General Atlantic, if you're one of the LPs who invested in creative planning through this General Atlantic deal back in 2020, you made a lot of money.
Yeah. The value of that went up significantly. Yes. And now you want to realize some of that gain.
Exactly. You're minting it based on that new valuation print.
Got it. That's really interesting. And let's take a step sort of back and think about this in a wider context. So this may not be the first time this has ever happened in RAA land, but it's the first one certainly of such note and certainly recently. So is this something we can expect to see more of? I suppose the context here in sort of the broader private equity landscape is that there are, and again, this may not at all relate to creative planning, we should say, but generally there are pressures on some PE funds to sort of, you know, exits aren't coming up as quickly. Obviously, we know that sort of IPOs aren't looking like what they were. We are seeing a sort of more headlines around secondary sales, more headlines around NAV loans, more headlines around basically different ways to get liquidity for investors because, you know, the exits aren't there as perhaps people expected them to be. So in that context, or in others, in a sort of more positive way, such as in this case, do we expect to see more of this type of thing in RIA world, as it were?
I think that it's important to note that if you're a private equity firm, you generally, obviously there are some processes going on right now, but again, the general private equity investing thesis in RIAs is that they generate a lot of market-linked, but not totally market-linked returns with steady, predictable cash flow. And in this kind of environment you described where it's difficult for PE firms to raise funds, there's not much of an IPO market right now. Well, if you have a steady cash flow generating asset that you can consistently generate management fees off of, you're clinging on to that thing like Scrat from Ice Age holding on to the acorn that he found. This is a really valuable
definitely item. A reference everyone can get on board with, sure.
But no, I think that basically with, like you said, the ultimate exit, ultimate monetization events being more difficult to conceive with where the IPO market is and some of the hesitancies that some of these firms might have with selling to large sovereign wealth funds, I think you'll see some PE firms use this as an option going forward to extend the time horizon and keep taking in those management fees.
Got it. That's interesting. Okay. Well, look, let's sort of stick with deals and PE money, but pivot to a slightly different story, which is, I guess, a more straightforward one, a more, you know, a firm buying in to an RIA, which you'll tell us about in a moment. I don't want to blind item it for too long, but I suppose that speaks to the general sort of health and enthusiasm of private equity money into this space.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth noting that, look, this is still an incredibly hot space for PE investment based on the dynamics that we've described. That's why there are a lot of firms that are on the block right now, either looking to sell or looking to bring in new investors. So what's interesting is on Thursday morning, the day we recorded this podcast.
Yes, we introduced the story badly, listener. Yes. We're going to crack on, but yeah, what is the story we're alluding to here?
Mission Wealth, which is a large RA in Santa Barbara, California, with about $10.7 billion in assets, they sold a minority stake in itself to Great Hill Partners, which is one of those private equity firms that had been really, I don't want to say desperate, but really aggressively trying to get into this space. And they'd been going at it for multiple years. And they found one in a firm like Mission that does not have any institutional backing, broad employee ownership base, north of 50 partners, strong asset base. And yeah, they got a deal done. I mean, they tried for, it's been at least about 2 years since they brought on John Warner from Wealth Enhancement, formerly Wealth Enhancement Group, to serve as a certain executive residence, helping them find RIA deals. It's not easy. And they found one.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that's a really good point, isn't it? If you're coming in for the first time, if you want to be the first institutional investor backer in one of these businesses and not join an existing one already or not, you know, buy someone else's stake, there are fewer good options than there were. That obviously all the, I hesitate to use the phrase low-hanging fruit because that implies a sort of level of ease or a level of sort of lack of quality, which is not the case. But all the obvious options have pretty much been explored. And you would have thought that for the most part, those holding out, if they'd held out that long, what were they necessarily going to wait for? So, okay. So they brought on someone you alluded to in 2023, what, specifically to go out and find something.
Yes, he was specifically designed to help him find wealth management and wealth tech investments.
And this is an unfair question because I didn't ask you to prep for this before we sat down. But obviously, a lot of stats about Q1 this year are rendered not entirely irrelevant, but they all came before, obviously, Liberation Day and the tariff shock and everything that sort of has happened since. But deal flow in Q1, still strong in the RIA world?
Yeah. I mean, I believe that it was Alec who I think wrote about the report from DeVoe, which said we had a record Q1 in M&A activity.
Yep, indeed. It was the strongest that they've seen so far in a Q1.
Was that strongest on number of deals, size of deals?
Yeah, on number of deals.
Number of deals. Okay. Yeah. So yeah, still, to your point, Ian, very much a hot space. And I think what we should take away from the creative story this week is obviously one of GA wanting to stay with its investment and finding a way to do that effectively.
Exactly.
Alec, good that you came in there, because we do want to talk to you as well. You're not just here, for the ambience, but you brought that
just to laugh at the Ice Age
spades.
References.
And... Yeah, well, the Ice Age references. They come thick and fast, so try to keep up, I guess. You're here to talk about a story which has got nothing to do with PE. There's a sort of labor joke here I want to make about sort of egregious fees, but I can't quite make it. You're here to talk about the CFP board and how it has raised its annual fees this week. So I guess kick us off with what's the story, and then we'll get into some questions after that.
Yeah, so the CFP board, which is one of the primary credentialing bodies, in our industry, has around 104,000 members, decided to raise its annual certification fee to $575 from its previous mark of $455. And that's going to apply to both, renewals and new certificates, starting on October 1st. And the main purpose of it essentially is to create kind of an expanded public awareness campaign, according to the CFP board. And it's essentially going to fund kind of a moving forward, what they claim is going to be a $30 million advertising, apparatus essentially, centered around, two times of the year, around tax season in the spring and year-end planning in the fall. And that'll be across, TV, in print, across social media. And
that'll be to promote the concept of a CFP. So to sort of straight out to consumers saying, you need to work with a CFP for these things. They're
essentially, it's for...
They're better than the rest.
Right. Yeah. I mean, essentially for brand awareness. And, I spoke with CFP board chair Liz Miller yesterday, and she essentially said that, every time she kind of goes out and speaks to CFPs, they bring that up as a top priority to her. And that's why they felt it was necessary to kind of institute this $120 raise.
Okay. But I suppose a couple of questions. The first would be, how have people taken it? Because, it's a meaningful raise. And as I understand it, it's not the first time they've raised. Like they have raised somewhat recently as well. So maybe fill us in on the previous hikes, but also, what sort of reaction you've gleaned so far.
That's right. Yeah, the last fee increase was $100 in 2022, of which $15 was kind of invested into this public awareness campaign. And I should say the public campaign, awareness campaign essentially started in 2011. So it's been, building to this point. But that's pretty much a major increase, because this time around, they said that they're going to be taking $280 earmarked from that total to use this time for the public awareness campaign. Back to your point, I mean, the response has been a bit mixed, to be fair, from a lot of CFP members, especially just kind of scrolling through LinkedIn the last couple of days. Jeffrey Levine, who's the chief planning officer of Focus Partners Wealth, one of the major players in our space, kind of posted about that annual fee raise, and got a litany of kind of responses from folks. One that I wanted to read out that I thought was pretty interesting was from a CFP named Tatum Schuler. He said, we put in the work studying for the board exam at the expense of other endeavors, and we do the ongoing continuing education, but yet we're required to pay ever-increasing annual dues for what in return? The privilege of using the mark. I had the same thought this morning when I received the email about whether the continued use will be worth it in the long run. So I think that to some extent, some folks kind of said that, it is kind of important to have, more public awareness, but then, there are responses like that one that kind of emphasize, the strength that this might put on certain folks and whether they want to remain members.
Yeah, really interesting. I mean, yeah, obviously we should say that's obviously just one person's view. And to your point, when you spoke to the chairperson of the board, they said this was a key bit of feedback they got was raising awareness. So I suppose that they're trying to deliver on the feedback they're getting, I guess. But anytime you put prices up, you're always going to get questions about why. Very much a mixed bag then in terms of the response, it sounds like. Is there any other sort of context that we should be aware of here? I suppose if one was being a little critical, one could say there is also where this hits hardest is around sort of people trying to get into the space. You know, possibly if you're up and running and you've got your CFP and you've got a practice or you're employed at a firm, you know, an extra $125, while not ideal, is probably something you can handle. But if you're thinking about applying or you're at an earlier stage, does this have more of an impact there?
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, I've spent a good amount of time kind of reporting on the barriers to entry as far as just in the advisory space overall, even in the last year. And, you know, when I spoke with the CFP board chair, Miller, you know, she said that the board wasn't insensitive to, you know, the issues that folks might have, you know, but this obviously, as we said, they deemed it a top priority. But, you know, there is kind of an irony, I guess, to a certain extent that, you know, the CFP board has, you know, been at the forefront of, you know, pushing for, you know, lowering the barriers to entry and, you know, increasing awareness to kind of bring folks into the space, and yet at the same time is increasing this annual fee.
Really quickly, because again, you know, it wasn't necessarily the focus of this particular piece. What are the main barriers of entry to sort of getting into financial planning or more broadly financial advice, I suppose?
Yeah. I mean, I think the cost obviously is a considerable factor.
You know, sort of cost of doing qualifications.
Cost of qualifications and exams and all of that. You know, I think obviously, you know, there are, you know, particular challenges for women and people of color in the space, you know, who have difficulty as far as, you know, even just trying to get into certain access to certain training programs and things like that. You know, I've written a fair bit about the externship, which is, you know, run by Hannah Moore, and that effort to kind of bring more of those folks into the space. Yeah, and so I think those are just a few, but, you know, I think it becomes more difficult to get, you know, especially at some of the more, you know, large wirehouses and other, you know, kind of more established RIAs. At a certain point, you know, they want folks with more qualifications, but, you know, it becomes difficult to even get to that point in the first place if you don't have a place to kind of start.
Got it. That makes sense. Well, look, a really nice, interesting array of stories there from the last week. Ian, as the sort of master of all news in the world of Citywire RIA, any other stories that we should have covered that we haven't?
I mean, I don't think there's any room to cover the Revenge of the Sith re-release on the website.
Yeah, not a relevant story for this audience. It's like the Pokemon question. You can't get all these extracurricular activities you're bringing in. Well, you and Alec have both seen the re-release of the Revenge of the Sith. And
I wish there was space, you know.
Yeah, if only there was. Oh, what's that? We're out of time, listener. Yeah, I agree. Well, look, if you want those thoughts, message us directly and 2 out of 3 of us will willingly get back to you on that. But otherwise, we'll leave it there and say a big thank you to Alec, a big thank you to Ian, and a big thank you to you, listener, for joining us. And we'll be back again for another episode of This Week in Wealth.